From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It was not the astounded crowd of his first inaugural, agog at the swearing-in of the nation's first black president, but it was a big crowd, and the man of the hour, Barack Obama, was ready to think big about the common good and the global moment.
My fellow Americans, we are made for this moment, and we will seize it so long as we seize it together.
Together, a big word yesterday on prosperity, immigration, climate change, gay rights, Medicare, Social Security. This hour on Point, President Obama's inaugural address and the second term ahead. You can join the conversation. What did you think of the president's speech, his vision, his almost agenda? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us today from Washington is David Gergen, advisor to Presidents Nixon, Reagan, Ford, and Bill Clinton, senior political analyst for CNN, professor of public service at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. With us today from Washington, David Gergen, welcome. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Tom. It's good to be here again.
Also with us from Washington is Edna Greene Medford, professor of history at Howard University, author of the Emancipation Proclamation, Three Views. Edna Greene Medford, thank you so much and welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Tom.
David Gergen, first to you, your big takeaway from this speech, the beginning of a second term in a still historic presidency.
In my judgment, it was one of the most important speeches of Barack Obama's career. It was very much a liberated Obama that we saw yesterday, someone who came into office who felt he was carrying the weights of the economic recession, as well as the other problems we were experiencing, two wars. And he feels we're now coming out of that, that he's liberated in that sense. He's liberated in another sense, and that is in the first term he tried very hard to get along with the Republicans. He felt rebuffed by them on several occasions. So he doesn't feel he has to go down that road. It doesn't lead anywhere from his point of view. And finally, in many ways, you know, the rebuke he got in 2010, he reversed by winning a re-election in 2012, as he did. All of that gave him, I think, power, and he used this occasion to set forth the most audacious embrace of liberalism, contemporary liberalism, that we've heard in some decades. He was more Lyndon Johnson than any Democratic president we've had since those days. I'd love to hear more from Edna, but I also thought he wrapped himself in the cloak of not only Martin Luther King, but Abraham Lincoln. And there was a direct connection in his emphasis upon the Declaration of Independence, the second paragraph of that declaration that goes back to King at the Lincoln Memorial in 1963, and from there back to Abraham Lincoln, not only with the Emancipation Proclamation, but with the Gettysburg Address in 1863.
Lots of historical references in the speech yesterday. Edna Greene Medford, we all remember his first inaugural and the many eyes that were not dry in that big crowd. And here we are, the second inaugural. What was your sense of the man in the moment this time compared to last, Edna?
Well, I think in both instances, it was they were extraordinary experiences. The first time, of course, because this was the first time that we had a man of color being sworn in as president of the United States. It was extraordinary the second time because he had been reelected. I think if he had not been reelected, of course, there would have been people who could say, well, the first time was a fluke. Well, we know now that it was no fluke, that the people decided what they wanted. And so he is now our president for the second time. I thought his address was extraordinary. It was both simple and profound at the same time. Very inclusive. He talked about equality. He talked about us all being Americans. And I think he said some things in that speech that many of us had been hoping that he would say for a long time. And so we're delighted that he did get around to it.
What was the cultural message for you, Edna Greene Medford, of seeing this president there again, inaugurated for a second time? That in itself, does it say to you, it wasn't a fluke and we have reached a new era? Or how do you interpret, this is partly in color terms, I guess, that he's back, he's reelected, he's there?
Absolutely. It gives me hope, but I think we can go too far. if we believe that we're in some kind of post-racial society. It's what everyone talked about the first time, because we'd elected an African-American president. We were in this post-racial era. I think we found out afterwards, especially as a consequence of all of the hassles that he's received from certain elements of the society, we're not at all in a post-racial society. But it does give us hope that we're moving in the right direction.
David Gergen, I want to ask you about this word and idea. You say audacious liberalism. Certainly, the idea of collective action and doing things together came up again and again in this speech. You know, the president saying we can no more meet the demands of today's world by acting alone than soldiers could have in the face of fascism or communism with muskets and militias. Or, you know, again and again, this theme of Americans acting together and the necessity of that. Let's listen just a little here from early in the speech.
Our celebration of initiative and enterprise, our insistence on hard work and personal responsibility, these are constants in our character. But we have always understood that when times change, so must we. That fidelity to our founding principles requires new responses to new challenges. That preserving our individual freedoms ultimately requires collective action.
David Gergen, preserving our individual freedoms ultimately requires collective action. This theme of the together requirement, the collective requirement, coming up again and again in this speech, is that the new liberalism, the contemporary liberalism you're describing?
Yes, it's a familiar liberalism for those who, you know, watched Franklin Roosevelt in office and the legacy he left behind, and then that legacy was continued by John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. But then the Democratic Party departed from that, and we had, you know, the only way the Democrats could get people in the White House was they elected centrists, people who drew some elements of that, but also, you know, like Bill Clinton and Jimmy Carter. Mm-hmm. And in this speech, Barack Obama has very much gone back to that older liberalism. And that is the sense of collective action actually increases freedom. It doesn't diminish freedom. To use a distinction that Isaiah Berlin, some call him Isaiah Berlin, mm-hmm. Made about freedom. He argued that in the beginning, the American experience was all about negative liberty. And that is, keep the government away from me as an individual. That I will prosper best, I will live best when I have less government. And Roosevelt came along and provided, especially in his 1944 State of the Union address, what Berlin called a vision of positive liberty, not negative liberty. And that is that the argument that we need government effectively intervening in the lives, especially of those who are vulnerable, in order to free them. That government intervention, in effect, strengthens you and allows you to live a full life. That's a very different view of freedom, and it's sharply different, and why we're going to have such contentious debates in the months ahead from the conservative view of what freedom is.
I mean, that notion, keep government away from me, as an old version of liberty. You say it's old, and certainly it is, but
it's also the Bill of Rights.
It's the Bill of Rights, but it's also right here in the opposition party today.
Absolutely. It's and the clash that we now have is it fundamentally Barack Obama is driving the Democratic Party to embrace the notion of equality as our founding creed, equality of opportunity, and Republicans instead are arguing, no, it's the freedom of the individual that's our founding creed.
And does that sound to you like a recipe for collective action or a recipe for more political division? You know how strong views are on exactly this front.
Go ahead, Ed.
Well, I certainly do see more political division. But I think that we need to recognize, and the opposition group needs to recognize, that the people have spoken and they've indicated what it is they want. And it seems to me that their sense of liberty corresponds with exactly what the president was saying yesterday. And so, you know, we talk about, you know, what will be the president's legacy. I think the legacy can be an extraordinary one if he's given the opportunity to really change America in the way that we know it can be changed and in the way that it should be changed. But whether or not he's going to be given the opportunity to do that is questionable.
Tom, let me say one other thing that I think differentiates the speech so much from what we normally have heard in inauguration addresses. Time and again, when presidents have come to take the inaugural address, and they talk about American heroes. They talk about young men and women who died in combat. Mm-hmm. President Reagan, 1981, ended it with a flourish about a soldier who died in the First World War and what an American hero he was. Along comes Barack Obama this time, and who are his heroes? Who does he talk about? Mm. He goes to a litany, starting with Seneca Falls.
Women.
And Selma. Mm-hmm. And Stonewall.
Blacks.
It's an inclusive,
mm-hmm.
yeah, it's an inclusive vision. It's about embracing American diversity. It's a very different litany of who our heroes are, who the pioneers were. To go to women seeking rights, to go to African Americans seeking rights, people of color seeking rights, to gays now seeking rights. I thought it was particularly audacious with regard to gays. We've never heard a president talk about that. It's going to, but it, again, I do think it's going to invite a lot of divisions ahead, but it you have to say up front, he took a stand. And it's not a stand, it's a much clearer stand than what we've heard from him in the past.
And just as public a stand as anybody could make, we're talking about the president's second inaugural address with David Gergen and Edna Greene Medford. Behind us, that Brooklyn Tabernacle Choir, you heard them on the west front of the Capitol building yesterday. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. James Taylor there yesterday for the second inauguration of President Barack Obama there on the west front of the Capitol building, that always stirring scene of hundreds of thousands gathered on the enormous National Mall, and stretching all the way back one way and another to those who were listening at the Lincoln Memorial at the other end. We're looking at the president's inaugural address, his second and the second term ahead today, with Edna Greene Medford of Howard University, David Gergen, senior political analyst for CNN, advisor to many presidents over the years. David, Edna, let me get a couple of callers right in here. Anna in Cookeville, Tennessee. Anna, thanks for calling. What did you think?
Yes, hi, Tom. Thanks so much, and thank you for your distinguished guest as well. You know, I thought it was so moving, made me so proud to be an American. I do not agree with a lot of Obama's policies. I just thought it was so brilliant how it showed fundamental political views about the power of the individual versus the power of government. So it was so slick how it was polarizing yet unifying all in one. It was pretty amazing.
That's a trick. What policies do you not agree with the president on, Anna?
Well, you know, I know David Gergen talked about this earlier about the power of the individual versus the role of government. And you know, I just feel like, you know, we were kind of pulling up by the bootstraps, and we all, you know, work hard, I guess, the country's built on hard work, not social policy.
And it sounds like that's where you come down, but you were moved yesterday. And I appreciate your call. Let me get one more right here from Nashville. Carl, you're on the air, Carl.
Well, I tell you what I took from it. We the people. I think that it was a perfect speech to rebuttal the selfishness of Ronald Reagan and the Republican Party over the past 30 years. It was a perfect speech to rebuttal the ininclusiveness of the Republican Party. And as a black person in this country, the way I see the Republican Party is, if you're not old, white, a man, and evangelical, you're not invited. And yesterday, he perfectly invited the United States of America to get behind the United States of America. It just makes the other party look small and ininclusive.
Well, Carl, I appreciate your call as well. David Gergen, you know, you can hear right there Anna, who liked the tone of the president's speech but wants to go. She always goes back to bootstraps and individual effort. Carl, who says enough with that kind of Reagan-era theme of individualism. Are we closing demographically, politically, philosophically, a book on that era, or is that still going to be a wide open contest, David?
It's still very much in play. We haven't resolved this, and I think President Obama yesterday recognized we'll never resolve it because we'll always be seeking new balances. To go back to Anna's point, how do you balance an emphasis on freedom with an emphasis upon collective action? An emphasis upon achieving equality, and it's always how we strike that balance that becomes the fight, Tom. Because you're going to, both strains are very, very important to the American identity, American creed, and most of our recent history has been a struggle between those who want more liberty and less government, or less emphasis upon equality, versus those who think, no. If you're leaving too many people behind in this cutthroat society. And the government needs to intervene and make sure that we don't have as much inequality. So that balance is could be. I think the president was absolutely on point when he said that yesterday. To go to Carl's point, which I thought both Anna and Carl were remarkably interesting comments. Carl put it well in the sense that there are a lot of people who have felt that the Republican Party is not welcoming to them. Take Latinos, for example, who were here. They feel that the immigration policies of the Republicans have been sort of divisive and alienating. And here the president stands up and invites them in. He had a strong passage yesterday about immigration and about people who are not Caucasians. And that I think that's one of the challenges the Republican Party faces, because it has... It was perceived in this election as moving toward becoming too extreme and becoming not in favor of diversity, embracing diversity. So I think President Obama has seen an opening, and he intends to build a new majority among people who don't feel comfortable with the current Republican Party. And the Republican Party has become very introspective. It's beginning to recognize it does need to speak out. That's why Marco Rubio, for example, the senator, Republican senator from Florida, is pushing a different immigration bill than what we've seen in the past.
Edna Greene Medford, the election of last fall may have been a real wake-up call to a lot of Republicans. There certainly seems to be more openness on the immigration legislative front right now. On the other hand, this goes to this core issue of what is it about? Is it about collective action? Is it about individual gumption? And Republicans again and again saying, do not forget, it's the collective result of individual gumption that has given this country its edge. How do we resolve that? I mean, the president nods to it right there. He says, our insistence on hard work, personal responsibility, these are constants in our character. But he went by that pretty fast, Edna, to a big emphasis on the collective, the work together. What matters here?
I don't see that there's necessarily tension between the two. Why can't we have both? I always find it fascinating that there's a segment of the population that's concerned about big government and want more limited government until there is an issue involving them. And then they want big government. Mm-hmm. And so certainly we understand that people should have personal responsibility. But we also are a nation that we claim that we're always talking about God bless America. And we don't seem to want to do anything to help some of us. Don't seem to want to do anything to help the least among us, those people who need help. And so if we want God to bless America, do we not have an obligation to those people who cannot help themselves, or whether it's something that's constant or something that is momentary?
Republicans say, well, that commitment is fine, but things are out of whack, that our fiscal resources don't match our commitments, and we can't ignore that, Edna.
Perhaps not. But, we have to find solutions to these problems. We just can't leave people by the wayside because we want to move forward and we don't feel that they have been totally responsible. There has got to be a solution that's going to pull both of those together. Yes, individual responsibility, but some kind of assistance from government as well when it is needed. We are the government, so it's not like there's some kind of separate entity out there that is sort of lording over us.
Here's the president yesterday being very explicit on exactly this front, the president on the steps of the Capitol building.
The commitments we make to each other through Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security. These things do not sap our initiative. They strengthen us. They do not make us a nation of takers. They free us to take the risks that make this country great.
David Gergen, how about that formulation right there?
Well, it was a direct rebuke of Mitt Romney there.
Mm-hmm.
They don't make us a nation of
takers.
Of takers, which is one of the things he was arguing. I was thinking, Tom, actually, wondering and really coming to the conclusion, how much voting does matter? Can you imagine how different it would have been yesterday if Mitt Romney had actually won the election and he was the one being inaugurated?
Yeah.
How different the conversation would have been.
The message.
How different the message, the crowds, the whole feeling of it would have been so different. Voting does matter. It matters a lot. And, you know, the truth is the president won fair and square in part by mobilizing a lot of people of color, a lot of young people, a lot of women. And that coalition is very, very powerful now. And I think one of the president's hopes is he can leave behind, just as FDR did, a coalition that will govern the country for some time. But to go to your question about this trade-off, there's every major political figure at the gubernatorial level, at the mayoralty level, and at the national level is dealing with these tough, tough trade-offs between how do you help those who are vulnerable and still afford it, and not become a society which, you know, stretches way beyond its means. And the president yesterday, who has been talking about balance, I thought came down firmly on the side of we are first and foremost going to protect people, and we're going to protect these programs like Medicare and Social Security. Any thought that we are going to have dramatic entitlement reform signed on to by this president, I think went out the window yesterday. And that's one of the reasons the Republicans feel that it's going to be very, very hard that he was he threw down the gauntlet from their point of view. And you're going to hear a lot more about that. And I think the days ahead, conservatives were very unhappy about the speech.
Well, voting matters. Elections matter. And the people, as Edna says, have spoken. On the other hand, they also elected a Republican majority in the House. Here was a president talking about the role of government and saying, look, we don't have to solve everything. Let's just get going. And let's be mindful of how we do it.
Progress does not compel us to settle centuries-long debates about the role of government for all time, but it does require us to act in our time. For now, decisions are upon us, and we cannot afford delay. We cannot mistake absolutism for principle or substitute spectacle for politics, or treat name-calling as reasoned debate.
Edna Greene-Mifford, I want to come to you on that, but David Gergen first. I mean, there's sort of talk about twisting the tail of your opponent right there very publicly.
Absolutely.
But what about this? Maybe it's a rhetorical trick. Maybe it's a governing hope, but we don't have to settle this debate. We just have to act. How do you do that without some kind of consensus?
Well, I think the president had a pretty realistic appreciation that this is going to be a tough road. He's putting forward an agenda that is extremely ambitious. And he knows he's only got about a year to a year and a half before his power starts winding down domestically. And he knows he's not going to get all of this. Everybody, you know, the talk of the press corps yesterday here in Washington was, how is it that he's put forward, knowing how little he can get done, how is it he's putting forward such a bold and ambitious agenda? And I think that he made the point then that we're not going to get it all done right away. But this is my vision for what America should be. And I think that that's why the speech also gets this historical perspective. But time to come back to it. There was, in contrast to the first inaugural, when he talked a lot about bipartisanship and working together, he's moved away from that now. I think he felt it didn't work very well. Certainly his liberal base thinks it didn't work very well. I think Edna probably feels that the Republicans, you know, tried to block him at every turn. But I thought one of the best tweets that captured the essence of the speech came out yesterday from a political scientist named Ian Bremmer. And he said that the essential message from President Obama was, together, we will pursue my objectives.
Together, right.
Together, we'll pursue my objectives.
Right, and toward a freshened understanding of equality. Here he talked about the middle class as being required as the shoulders of our prosperity. He talked about an America thriving when every person can find independence and pride in their work. And talked about one little girl.
We are true to our creed when a little girl born into the bleakest poverty knows that she has the same chance to succeed as anybody else because she is an American, she is free, and she is equal, not just in the eyes of God, but also in our own.
Edna Greene Medford, this came on Martin Luther King Day. It came in an anniversary year, 50th, of the I Have a Dream speech. I mean, lots of people were very mindful of this yesterday, listening to the president there on the Mall in Washington. What about what's coming to pass here, in your view, in this 50th anniversary year of that speech, watching this president step up for a second time in these terms of equality in this country?
Yeah, it does mean that we're coming closer to Dr. King's dream. I thought yesterday that Obama was rather Lincoln-esque as well. In Lincoln's second inaugural address, he's talking about with malice towards none, with charity for all. Mm-hmm. He's talking about inclusion. And that's what I heard. I didn't hear the partisanship that I'm hearing other people talk about. I heard inclusiveness. I heard the idea of equality of opportunity for all Americans. I heard him latch onto what Dr. King was talking about and what so many other civil rights leaders have been talking about through the ages. What I'm surprised at is that anyone would have a problem with those kinds of things. If we believe that America was founded on the idea of the equality of all men or mankind, mm-hmm. because that includes mm-hmm. women, mm-hmm. then why would we have a problem with a president saying that we need to be inclusive of all Americans?
David?
I think that, fortunately, one of the great traditions in this country is that periodically we have these debates about inclusiveness. We started out only having the suffrage for white men and people of property. And every time we've had a debate about this, we've resolved it in favor of more inclusiveness. Edna's absolutely right. And we've now reached the point where the President of the United States has set forth in a way that no one ever would have expected a strong statement about the inclusiveness of gays in our society, mm-hmm. about the embrace of that, and bringing them together with women's rights and the rights of people of color. I think all of that is something which is, I think the President deserves credit for making that more of a consensus point of view. The argument is not about inclusiveness, although there are some people, obviously, Tom, who are still resisting, but they're the outliers now. Mm-hmm. This country has changed dramatically on gay marriage just in the last few years to be much more inclusive, thankfully, about that as well. But I think there is a very strong argument about the role of government in helping those who are on the bottom half. How far should we go? Who exactly should be helping with how much? Is it equality of opportunity or is it equality of results that we're looking for?
And what does equality of opportunity really mean? David Gergen, please stand by in Washington, D.C. Edna Greene Medford of Howard University, I know we have to let you go. It's been great to have you with us today, Edna. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
Edna Greene Medford, author of The Emancipation Proclamation. With malice toward none, with charity for all, firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right, said Lincoln in his second inaugural. Beyonce behind us with the Star Spangled Banner. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about President Barack Obama's inaugural address and the second term ahead. The president said it's going to take citizens speaking up to enact his vision. Here he is toward the end of his speech.
You and I, as citizens, have the power to set this country's course. You and I, as citizens, have the obligation to shape the debates of our time, not only with the votes we cast, but with the voices we lift in defense of our most ancient values and enduring ideals.
His vision, put always in terms of most ancient values and enduring ideals. David Gergen joins us today from Washington, D.C. He served as an advisor to Presidents Reagan, Nixon, Ford, Bill Clinton, senior political analyst at CNN, and very glad to have him with us. With us as well right now from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beattie joins us. He was listening very closely yesterday and today. Jack, it's great to have you. What did you think of this speech?
Hello, Tom. Well, I was very impressed, as David was. I was especially struck with the vision of a lasting peace, as the president says, that does not require perpetual war. Now, he's referring there to the end of a decade and more of war. And, you know, maybe this year combat operations will end in Afghanistan. But he went on and he said that we're the heirs of those who won the peace, and not just the war, those who, quote, turned sworn enemies into the surest of friends. Whom could he be referring to there? Well, I think in the next paragraph we get a sense where he said engagement can durably lift suspicion and fear. Engagement is a first-term word that was used with regard to, among other places, Iran. And, you know, I think the president is indicating he understands that the vision of a lasting peace, there's no place in there for a war with Iran. And, you know, before the election, actually the day before the foreign policy debate between Governor Romney and the president, the New York Times came out with a leak, big story, that we've been engaging in secret negotiations with Iran towards setting up a first face-to-face negotiation over the nuclear issue. The White House strenuously denied it. I'm guessing that's been going on at some level, and I'm hoping that it has, and that we're going to hear something about that, because the president has to know that war with Iran would be a shipwreck for his everything he hopes.
We've got that passage from the speech yesterday, Jack. David, let me play here. The president talking about strong alliances and engagement over war.
We will show the courage to try and resolve our differences with other nations peacefully, not because we are naive about the dangers we face, but because engagement can more durably lift suspicion and fear.
David Gergen, a rhetorical bulwark there against war with Iran?
I thought Jack was absolutely right about his argument. I was surprised that foreign policy received so little attention in the speech. It was mostly a domestic speech. Having said that, though, I think it's very clear the president wants desperately to avoid conflicts in his second term. He does want to concentrate on rebuilding America at home, and that starts with Iran, because that's been, you know, it's been overhanging of us now for a while. There are many who think 2013 is going to be the year of decision one way or the other. And the sense I have, Jack, is that he's asking John Kerry, as his new Secretary of State, to do two things. One is to aggressively pursue some sort of resolution with the Iranians before we get too far down the track, and that war becomes more and more likely, which is a real possibility. There are indications that the sanctions are biting sufficiently that the Iranian regime, it may be looking for a way out. And so I think that's one of Kerry's briefs. I think the other one that I've been hearing about in Washington is that he's looking to John Kerry to also help him on an issue that he now is getting quite concerned about, and that is the climate. And I think you're going to see carrying a lot of water on that one.
We've got listeners responding online here. Nancy says, I share his vision completely and am so ready to move beyond the politics of cynics and naysayers. Greg, on the other hand, says he wants us to hang our clothes on the line and ride bicycles to work in the rain. That's not progress. And on the philosophical point, a listener writes, I don't think there's a contradiction between we the people and rugged individualism. We the people give power to each individual to assert his, her rights and responsibilities. Eileen's calling from Duxbury, Massachusetts. Eileen, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I wanted to say that when I heard him talk about climate change, my heart leaped for joy. I feel like it has been the elephant in the room. There have been a lot of very pressing issues that we've been dealing with in the day-to-day life, but somehow they have kept what I think is probably the most important issue off the table. If we don't figure out how to work with our planet and how to modify our lifestyle so that we can adjust to the change that's here, not just coming, here. Mm-hmm. None of the rest matters.
Eileen, I appreciate your call. Jack, let me put that to you. Eileen says they've kept it off the table, but many critics said Barack Obama himself was not that vigorous a spokesperson for this angle of concern, the climate, in his first term.
Yes, in a New Yorker piece, Ryan Lizza said that he may go down as the, quote, James Buchanan of climate change, that he simply said he didn't want anything to do with it. But, you know, a president in the second term can do things, or at least can say things, that he couldn't say in the first term. However, when you look at this, if on the programmatics of domestic liberalism, there's this gap between what President Bush the first called our will and our wallet, on this front, the global climate change front, there just seems to be a political roadblock that any carbon tax, any move toward cap and trade, anything requiring legislation, that's out. So what do we have? We do have regulation, and some people think this is that in this passage, the president was doing two things. He was trying to insure himself against the criticism he's going to get for probably approving the Keystone pipeline. I expect that's going to come along.
After his earlier delay on that approval.
That's right. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, he was also preparing for tough regulations in the spring on plant emissions, and that may actually require the retirement of some power plants. So whatever happens is going to happen through regulation.
Sounded bold yesterday, but David Gergen, what about the gap between say and do on the climate front?
Well, my sense, Tom and Jack, is that he's shifting on this, that he is taking it more seriously. In the first term, it was widely understood that he tried to make a choice. He thought he had to make a choice between doing health care versus climate, and he came down on the side of health care and postponed climate. And since then, things, we've had all these storms. I think he was moved by Sandy, the storm, and how much damage it did. I think he felt that change maybe changed some of the political dynamics in the country. And yet, yes, he's going to go forward with Keystone in the second this year, I think. And I think Jack is right. He's also going to do something on the regulatory front that will please environmentalists, especially with regard to coal plants. But that he's looking for a more ambitious agenda. He doesn't quite know what to do with that. But I don't think carbon tax is totally out of the question. He needs to bargain hard with his Congress. For example, can he get something, if he does Keystone, can he get something in return from mm-hmm. some of the folks who are on the other side? If he opens up more federal land for exploration for gas and oil, especially for natural gas, can he get something in return? I think those are some of the tough questions he's going to face in this second term. But to go back to where we started, the other problem here, Tom, is how much time he's got. He doesn't have a lot of time because his power starts to run down next year. So how is he going to get all this done? I don't know, but I do see a renewed emphasis, and it's sincere. I don't think it was just a blocking action, that paragraph. It was a long paragraph in the speech.
Yes.
I'm told that when the historians went in to see him, as they did before the speech, that one of the subjects he brought up and dwelt on at some length was climate change and how worried he is about it.
But here we are. The time is not long, and the House of Representatives that he's looking at is Republican, and it will be Republican throughout this not long time, David Gergen.
It will be, and I think that's the here's where I think the real issue becomes and the hard part becomes. I entirely understand why the president was as aggressive as he was yesterday. I think it was one of the most important speeches of his career because it so clearly defined an embrace of the progressive tradition. But in the process, he also, if it were possible, I think alienated more Republicans, especially some of the Republicans in the Senate who were looking to work with him. And the question becomes, and being aggressive, does it become harder, even harder, in a divided Washington to get some things done? I don't know the answer to that question. I think it's one of the great mysteries or one of the great suspenseful questions we face in the second term.
Jack, a clarion call here envisioning a new consensus? Or, is the president, is this wishful thinking as that Congress will come right back into session behind him there on the Hill?
I think he's looking at a campaign model, really, of mobilization. That was you quoted that call at the end for mm-hmm. Citizen Voice. Mm-hmm. And he set up an organization now that essentially is going to continue the campaign into this term.
But what does it matter if you've got a sitting House?
Well, no.
GOP majority.
It's an outside strategy, mm-hmm. and I think he hopes somehow that will get you, the votes of maybe northeastern Republicans, upper Midwestern, and people from the Northwest. That group that has been voting at least a couple of times now toward Sandiade and other things,
yep.
so that he could perhaps set a fire under their constituents. I think that's I do think that's the model. It's not going to be let's meet. Tete-a-tete in a room with John Boehner. That, I think, is probably gone.
Cammie in Columbia, South Carolina. Cammie, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my question.
Sure.
Or my comments. Mm-hmm. I'm a 33-year-old lesbian, and living here in Columbia, South Carolina, as you can imagine, we don't have many rights. And I have been extremely critical of Barack Obama throughout his entire first term. But I was really inspired by his speech yesterday. And I thought it was so moving that he mentioned that he thought it was important for our gay brothers and sisters to be treated equal mm-hmm. under the law. And also that he mentioned love, because that is really what it's all about. So I hope that his words turn into some action in his second term.
It was very prominent, and it was moving. Did you expect that much direct, explicit attention from the president on this point, Cammie?
No, not at all. I expected him to ignore it. He had ignored it completely during his campaign, and it hadn't been LGBT rights had not been mentioned at all in any of the debates with Mitt Romney, nor in the vice presidential debate. And so I expected us to be ignored because it's sometimes not a very popular thing for him to talk about.
Cammie, I'm glad for your call. It's an important observation. Jack, the goalposts keep moving here. The expansive boundaries of freedom, the president said. And here it was, very explicitly moving, introducing a new embrace in this setting yesterday.
Yes, he said, for if we are truly created equal, then surely the love we commit to one another must be equal as well. A statement about gay marriage, John Roberts was 3 feet away. The Supreme Court is going to make some very important decisions on that front very soon. And I think the president, that was his, in terms of what he can do, it seems to me he's gone legislatively and administratively as far as he can with ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell and other things. It's now up to the courts. And I think that was a sort of a statement to the court that isn't this right? Doesn't love, doesn't equality require equality of treatment of love?
Gay rights, right there. Plenty of Spanish from the stage yesterday. The sort of turning of gears. The country moving yesterday. Mary in Newburyport, Massachusetts. Mary, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. I'm an Obama supporter, and I did vote for him in the two elections, and I was very, very inspired by his vision yesterday in his speech. I thought it was very moving, and throughout the whole thing, I kept saying, this is why I want to live in this country. It was very moving to me. There were a lot of memorable lines. But then later in the day, as I was thinking, I heard one commentator say that he did not speak to the 48% of the people who didn't vote for him. And I also have a lot of concerns about the deficit and the financial future of our country. And I do have to say, I don't think that was addressed at all. And I always knew he was smart enough to know that this was an issue. But I don't know, I'm starting to get the feeling that maybe he doesn't see it as important as I thought he saw it, or that it needs to be. So even though I thought it was as inspiring a speech as I've heard, I thought the diversity was I kept thinking there's no other country in the world that you would see this kind of diversity in a parade like this in an mm-hmm. event. So it's very moving, but I am very, very concerned that all of that is meaningless unless we can get our financial situation in order.
Mary, I appreciate your call. David Gerken, there's a listener of your yesterday as well, I bet inspired, but worried.
Very thoughtful response from Mary. I guess I say so that part because I had some of the same concerns. I thought he treated the deficits in the national debt as very secondary in the speech yesterday. Yes, he mentioned the word deficits, and yes, he mentioned tax reform. But I think that there are many signs now that he is embracing, say, a view that Paul Krugman has been arguing, and that is the deficits don't matter as much as we think they do. It's much more important to stimulate the economy. And I thought he had a if the argument is about do we get deficit reduction through entitlement reform and some sort of tax reform, mm-hmm. I think the president came down very squarely on the side of trying to defend the entitlement programs as they are. With some minor tinkering, he's not in for it. He wants to be. He put himself strongly on the side of the liberal side on this issue. The action is now going to move to the Senate, where Chuck Schumer and others are going to try to produce a budget. We'll see where that leads. But I have to say, I think the chances of getting a grand bargain are receding quickly.
Jack, just a few seconds here, but can the president reset the sort of foundation of the debate in that, however prominent that speech? Or are we right back where we were, you know, 6 months ago when it gears up again?
I'm afraid we are right back where we are. And a lot of the argument will be about what we owe posterity. The president used that word. He said we owe them a clean climate. The Republicans are going to say we owe them a clean balance sheet.
And there we are. Jack Beatty, it's always great to have you right here. Thank you so much, Jack.
Thank you.
And David Gergen of Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, advisor to many presidents, with us again today. And so grateful for that. David Gergen, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
It's good to be with you both. Take care.
We'll go out with Jennifer Hudson. Let's Stay Together. That Much sounds great. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.